All right, welcome to another edition of Men Matter. And today we have with us Jeff Watson. Jeff is a police officer with the Titusville Police Department in Florida, 11.5-year veteran, and resident mental health practitioner for the department in brief, has been a master's in mental health counseling in 2011, degreed in that, and has had a long-standing interest in the stress and occupational stress, particularly, that surrounds law enforcement, how to deal with that under the wide variety of the scope of law enforcement. And I'm going to talk about some of that today. Just to interject, one of those little things you hear about, and I'd like to hear. Jeff tells me that Titusville was founded after Colonel Titus, who essentially won Titusville in a hand of poker. Is that right, Jeff?
That is correct. He did.
Oh, how come I'm never... there's going to be no towns named after McGuire, not the way I play poker. How about... the best way to start, I think, is an introduction to law enforcement from the law enforcement professional's perspective, starting with, and I think a lot of people say, like many other professions, how did you get interested in that? And maybe from your own perspective start, and then walk us through the selection and the weeding out of folks who maybe aren't serious, and then academy, and how that, with an eye on what we're talking about, how that gets you sort of aware that there's stress coming and the stresses that you go through in the academy to be selected.
Oh, certainly. First of all, from my perspective, my entry into law enforcement came after 12 years of being in the Army. During that time, like many people around me, I watched a lot of reality TV. I saw cops. But there was something else to me. I felt drawn towards the profession of law enforcement, much out of a sense of duty. My family historically is a military family, and all of us from the Civil War on have served the country in some capacity. And so early on in my life, it was instilled in me a higher sense of duty to be something greater than yourself. When I left active duty in 1999, I went to the local police testing center, which for Brevard County is the Brevard County, or BCC's Department of Public Safety. There's police testing, and that is your first exposure to real law enforcement. Essentially, anyone could apply to be a police officer in Florida. Each state is different, and there is some states like North Carolina that require people to be sponsored prior to going to the academy, and Florida is not one of those. Essentially, in Florida, if you can apply and pass the background at police testing, essentially you're in the academy. That doesn't necessarily mean that you'll be hired, but at least you've met the minimum qualifications to attend the academy. Major cities like Orlando, Jacksonville, Metro Dade, and Miami, larger departments that can afford to sponsor people, they do, and the state agencies have their own independent academy separate from everyone else right outside of Tallahassee at the Pat Thomas Law Enforcement Center. So really, it's as much as it is the similar, a lot of it's different in the path that you take into law enforcement.
And once you're sort of in the academy, how does that... Well, you were in boot camp. Those of us who were in the Army went through a hazing, and I'll call it that because it's the nicest word I can use without being censored. You get pretty quickly immersed in sort of the first thing that crosses your mind, what have I got myself into? Is that true for a lot of folks who get in the academy? It's not TV.
Correct, and it is. For example, during police testing, they show you several videos from in-car video systems and patrol cars that capture an officer's death. And that video alone, for people that were questioning or kind of teetering on the edge, you'd never see those people again. They immediately say, you know what, it's not for me, that's too real, and they disappear. The academy is very good at teaching you hypervigilance. The issue is that you can't relieve yourself or you can't find a healthy outlet for this. Your hypervigilance gets stuck. And all the lessons they teach you in the academy are paid for in blood, meaning that a previous officer or former officer or someone throughout history has died or been gravely injured as a result of something, and they take those lessons from the real world and they bring those into the academy. And some people may last through the legal block, which is the first block in the academy. They may last halfway through, but some of them eventually, the stress from this, that concept alone of, hey, there's a good chance that I may be hurt or killed, washes a lot of people out. They just drop out over time.
How do you know that when you're in the academy, instructors have their sixth sense and their experience? But whether you want to say it from your perspective or just the generalities, how do you know you should be sitting in that chair saying, I'm going to join that long line? How do you know that that's where you want to be? Because like a lot of things, what you're learning and where you're going are two different things.
Oh, and correct. You're phrased correct in that aspect and that observation. When I went to the academy, to me, it just felt right. I was content. There was no desire to do anything else that seemed like I was at the right place at the right time. And as academy instructor, when we're teaching classes, you can see it on people's faces, whether they want to admit it or not. Yeah, some of them have the, you know, you call the deer in the headlight look. They're kind of shell-shocked at some of the lessons that you may teach them or some of the statements you may make in the class. And really what it comes down to is they're questioning not only themselves, but their reason to be there, especially those that weren't really aware of the totality of what you're exposed to. Them in particular, you can, as an instructor, you can spot them pretty easy. They're usually the ones that are, you know, again, their eyes are big as saucers and just kind of looking at you with this surprise look. And on break, when you break for lunch or a water break, they will actually come up to you and ask you more questions to kind of go more in depth into what you're talking about. And then at time, you can ask them, you know, what's your rationale behind the question? What were you thinking? Are you sure this is right for you? But it's individualized to each person.
When you were there, as you were looking around, did you think, how good, because you were in the Army, how good was your sense that this is a group of people I want to work with, I could work with, not the instructors, your contemporaries. Did you get a good sense of, in your own mind, this is the group of guys I want to, or gals to, my apologies, that I work with, I could be in law enforcement with these folks. Did that get in pretty quick? Other people had the same sort of mindset as you?
It did. My academy was pre-9/11, so those of us that were going in didn't have the 9/11 motivation to join. We hadn't been exposed to that yet as a profession. And by and large, most of us that were there either had family in law enforcement or friends or someone close to us that was like, I won't use the word role model, but a heavy influence in our decision to join law enforcement. In particular for me, my second cousin is a police officer. She recently retired in North Carolina, but outside of that, we're the only two cops in the entire family.
It does seem familial, doesn't it? My father and grandfather are both Marines, and I went the other way with the Army because there are no doctors. Those of our listeners don't know, there are no medical personnel in the Marines. That's why they use Navy medics, because all Marines are required to fight offensively. But my grandfather was also a mounted cop in New York City.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, kind of romantic stories. He was well versed in horse lore, so to speak, going in, and he really enjoyed it. And many times we'd sit around and he'd say, "Oh, doctor, I don't know, where did we go wrong?" So now you're in and you're getting close to getting out. You go through all the things in the academy. When you look back on it, is it a move to where you're actually going to be out and facing what you had thought you were going to have as a as an occupation? Do you get, in a sense, do you get the preparation for being out, even though you're going to go on with further training once you're out of the academy? Is it sufficient, do you think, from a mentally prepared perspective, you know, not to doing the job, but how you're creating a life mindset around the position?
I think that for me personally, and from my experience recently with my master's degree, the academy has the right intent, but they do not go into enough detail to provide successful resolution skills for stress. They kind of tap dance around the issue, and this is just us as a culture in America. One is, for those that don't know, white males are the highest risk for suicide out of any other group in America, as far as you want to classify white males, African American males, Native Americans. But they don't go into enough detail in the academy to properly give you some tools to help manage stress. Again, we tap dance around it. We don't really go into a lot of detail. And they, when I went to the academy, the basic, we had a 2-hour class, and the whole class consisted of, "Hey, look, you're going to see a lot of crazy stuff, and it's going to be gruesome, but you should have someone to talk to." But they, that's as far as they went. And they went around the room asking us, you know, "Who do you have?" For me, is my wife. But a lot of people said, "You know, I have nobody, but I don't think I'm going to have a problem." But some of them, when the academy graduated, we kind of went our separate ways. We were kind of scattered across Florida, and I've lost contact with some of them. But by and large, the academy could go a little bit deeper into that, I believe.
Now, that's when you went through it, and I've read and spoke. I know some folks in law enforcement. It seems that over the past, and I'm saying this in the past, meaning post 9/11, seems to be a lot more attention paid to the acute and chronic effects of stress from the job. Do you find that is what's going on now in law enforcement?
I do. One of the things that I've done for my agency is I founded the stress management team. The stress management team has two functions. One, it's a peer support team, and the other side is a CISM team. And since 9/11, one of the positives that's come out of this whole situation has been an increased interest in mental health, not only through our combat veterans, but into law enforcement, first responders, fire, EMS, and even, for example, sexual trauma. We all share across this whole spectrum the sense of hopelessness or helplessness or some other kind of trauma that brings on symptoms. And in 2000, the International Association of Chiefs of Police recognized a peer support team was a valid and highly encouraged unit for each department in America, essentially. And taking their recommendations from 2000 and my training in psychology, I formed the teams. The peer support team is for everyday stress. That bad call we just left, or, you know, the supervisor I have, you know, we're having a quote-unquote personality conflict. We don't really see eye to eye. And then the CISM team is for critical incidents that happen outside the scope of the peer support team, such as officer-involved shootings, or, for instance, one of our most recent uses for the CISM team for my agency, we had a robbery at a gas station. The suspect fled into the backyard of a neighboring house, and when officers confronted him, he held his handgun up to himself, to his head, and committed suicide in front of the officers. So we brought out CISM just to check in. Now, they may or may not have had any kind of issues from it, but we just wanted to bring CISM in just to check in to see how they're doing and just to let them know that we're there and no one's forgot about them as a person. And, no, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm listening. I just, finish up. I apologize. I had a question and starting to talk. I apologize for interrupting.
One of the things that we're prone for in law enforcement long term, it's not that one major incident or that one major call or that bad call. It's an acute onset from your entire career. We're more prone to things like dysthymia, which is a low-level onset of depression. Dysthymia is more easily classified as if you were to take a frog and put them in a pot of cold water and put them on the stove, and you turn the heat up, the frog will sit in the pot and boil, whereas if you threw the frog in the hot water, he would jump out. That's what dysthymia is. It starts off with nothing, and then it grows until it's a problem where it causes problems in daily functioning, relationships. We in law enforcement have a very high divorce rate, and it's dysthymia, PTSD, acute stress, major depressive disorder, even substance use is more common in law enforcement than in the general population.
When you find yourself, I guess to back up, the minimal intervention, if that's the correct word, for stress, is just peer-to-peer. What we used to call locker room psychology. You know, how you doing? Mm-hmm. Check on the guy. How you been? Come on over for dinner. That type thing. Is that kind of I'm sure it's probably the most common intervention, so to speak.
It is. Well, my department is relatively small compared to other major cities. We have 89 sworn and a total number of employees of 130. So we're more of a family atmosphere as opposed to a paramilitary organization, such as the way law enforcement is geared. And the peer intervention is number one across the entire spectrum. That's key for everyone. And luckily for us, we were able to recognize that and go to our peers and say, you know, for example, hey, Jim, I noticed that you're not being your usual self, or you seem kind of disconnected. You know, you want to talk about that or something going on? And it's all about FaceTime with law enforcement, meaning people that have been in around my time as far as years of service are more prone to talk to me than, say, a rookie approaching a veteran saying, hey, salty dog, I notice you're having a problem. You know, pound sand, rookie. Whereas, you know, for me, being in longer, it's like street credibility. They're more prone to open up and talk the longer you've been in.
And more prone to talk to somebody who's been in the same circumstance and had it before than, say, the outside, quote, counselor, which seems to be more of a label than a help.
Correct. The one of the things that I pride myself in is knowing that the peer support team is in place for these people, and my team has a wide range of experience, from a 22-year veteran to an officer that's only had 5 years of service. But it's people like that that are more easier to talk to and to listen, and we implement these services everywhere we can, and especially on the day-to-day stuff, when someone needs an intervention, they're there for them. And when we have this wide range of experience to pull from, then the officers can even ask, and this is the peer stuff, so there's no confidentiality or no moral turpitude for talking. They can say, how did you make it through this incident? And the peer person can say, look, it took me going out back to the back of my house with an aluminum bat, and I beat trees up in my backyard for about an hour one day, and then I had that release of anger, and now I'm fine. But stuff like that, it helps them along the way.
And you mentioned 9/11 as kind of being a turning point. I think that's done a lot of changes in a variety of professions, especially sort of those of us who are helping-minded, law enforcement particularly. Has it shifted from pre-9/11 to post-9/11. I've read several things and seen certain things written that while the security and self-protection and risk and the things you spoke about before were present beforehand, afterwards, it seems, as you mentioned, hypervigilance, it seems that it goes, it's knocked everything up a notch. Now there's more risk, there's more things to look for, and then the personal risk of law enforcement is up. So everything's up another notch at approaching that red line. Does that seem like an adequate way to describe that? I've seen that written several ways.
Absolutely. One of the things that seems to be a trend across America right now is violence against law enforcement. When we get into the job, we understand that there's inherent risks in the job and that we're willing to take those risks to make things happen and to essentially, in basic terms, serve and protect the public. Since 9/11 and of all the accolades and everything it's done for us, one of the things recently is increased violence on law enforcement. Recently, a San Diego police officer was shot and killed in his patrol car sitting in a red light. Essentially an unprovoked attack, and this seems to be a trend across America right now. For example, this year alone, the St. Petersburg Police Department's lost three officers in shootings that were just weeks apart. And it seems that a lot of it could be, you could say, the economy, suicide by cop, or for whatever reason, people know that if they point guns at cops, we're going to shoot back. It's how we're trained in the academy. And as this violence increases, it drives up the hypervigilance. Whereas before, you may be hypervigilant to an extent. Now all these officer deaths and all these ambushes, so to speak, are in the back of your mind when you're on the road. So it drives it up even farther, which obviously causes you problems when you try to come down when you go home.
So do you find yourself, like a lot of professions sometimes will – you know, play as much as they can to the altruistic side of things. But in the end, everyone will say at some point, you know, I feel totally unappreciated here. I'm breaking my back to do this. And, oh, my gosh, I mean, it's everybody, law enforcement, teachers, medicine. I'm sure the postman and now with all that going on is thinking the same thing. Does that equate to not just more stress, but to the public at large? Do they seem more stressful? Is the society just more tense anymore?
It does seem that way. In my career, the perception from the public a lot of times is that we're out to get people, or it's the goon squad, or you have quotas, etc. I can speak from Florida's perspective. There is no quota for traffic tickets in Florida, but some people seem to think that we have quotas. But I've seen the change in perception, especially recently, with budget cuts and, for example, law enforcement retirements were just usually kind of a chintzy retirement. You know, you had a long-term post-retirement time where you could considerably live comfortable. You're not going to, you know, live in a mansion, but you're going to live comfortable. Now those retirements are coming under scrutiny, and some people have some animosity because there's a guaranteed retirement. But again, they're not really aware of the inherent risks that we take every day.
I'm in agreement with that, and especially also for our veterans. Well, I think the average combat soldier, serviceman, I think, is somewhere in the neighborhood of 38,000 a year. 38,000, 40,000, I think I read. That's overall average. That's not a lot considering what you're up against. And I think that people have the wrong idea of both law enforcement and other security measures. It takes a lot. Hypervigilance, I tell my patients sometimes, especially here in Alaska where people fly a lot, that you got to be on guard on approaching stall speed. Some folks just don't see it coming. And it may not have to be a tragic outcome, but it certainly is burnout or lassitude or anger. There's a lot of ways people can do that. In your department, in your experience, things are in place or you have that sixth sense or that closeness or that small department where you can say, we need to sit down and chat or how's it going? Or you find that that's an advantage in a smaller department to be able to say, something's not right, let's sit down and talk about this, or we're going to pair you up with one of the guys that's been there forever and let him quietly just ride around with you or be with you for a while, for a few days or a week. Is that an intervention type or an observation thing that you guys use?
It is, and luckily for us, we're so far, you know, knock on wood, we've been very successful with that, where we can, because we're small, we can know when you're having an issue, and by the time that, like, say, your supervisor becomes aware of it, it's pretty much common knowledge in on your squad of what's going on. And I don't mean that negatively. An example would be if you're going through a divorce, you know, bad news travels fast, and it doesn't take long before everyone knows, hey, so-and-so's going through a divorce. So we know from past experience and through research studies that there's going to be a change in his behavior or her behavior. There's going to be possibly the a use of force complaints or complaints in general from the public. The officer is being mean. And for those that aren't familiar with law enforcement or are curious, I would highly recommend any of them anytime go to a local agency that allows ride-alongs. So you can ride with the officer and see exactly what they're exposed to on a daily basis. For my department, it's required to have a waiver, and you can ride along, and you can ride, I believe it's 3 times within a month, and it gives you more of appreciation of just all the stuff that goes along with it and why officers act the way they do. For all the bad examples that make it to YouTube or onto Facebook or news stories, just remember we're all human, and at the end of the day, I get up in the morning and put my pants on the same way everybody in America does, one leg at a time. And remembering that and being humble has made me successful in trying to maintain my humanistic approach. The issue is with hypervigilance in law enforcement is that that person who, I won't use the word falls victim to it, but they're the officer that can't or doesn't have an outlet for their anger or their frustration. It just kind of feeds on itself a lot like cancer. And with that, videos make it to YouTube or they may the news stories. We're, again, human like everyone else. It's a pseudo-government job, and sometimes bad apples make it into the bunch.
Yeah, I find that disturbing that it's put on some of these sites as the norm or as the typical or as is often presented, this happens all the time. We just happen to catch this on film. It turns my stomach, to be honest with you. It's just it's the wrong approach, and I think I shouldn't even say approach. It's the wrong thing to do to make it sound like there's a risk in having a law enforcement at all. I mean, that's kind of how some of that is presented, and it really does. It turns my stomach to think that. I mean, I sleep well at night knowing somebody's out watching my back. And it's a shame it isn't put in that vein more. But without lingering on that, because we could spend all day on the YouTube craziness. And we spoke about this before. So you've been doing all this time. What are, now, Sans, without going into the shooting scenarios, for me, and we spoke about this, I have friends who are in law enforcement, it always seemed to me that the most scary, for me in any way, the scariest thing I've ever heard any of these folks describe is the traffic stop. Am I close?
Yes. The the traffic stop is a myriad of stress factors. The news always uses the word routine. That's one of those words that you kind of have to deal with, but it kind of detests that word. No traffic stop is routine. Each traffic stop differs, even in the same area, depending on what car you stop, what time of day it is. Is there a tent? No tent. And it's the fear of the unknown. And once you're in law enforcement, one of the things that we get is training tools, is a series of videos called In the Line of Duty. And ever so often, they circulate around the country, and you see videos on traffic stops where things went south and someone lost their life. And it always stays in the back of your mind when you're walking up to the car. You know, is this my time? Is this the car that's going to, you know, essentially get me? So when people see this on traffic stops as citizens, they may view the officer as being overly aggressive, or the officer was amped up. Well, of course, it's an adrenaline dump, because walking up to the car, it could be anybody. And until we walk up and make contact with the person driving or the person's in the vehicle, we have no idea who it could be. And the lessons learned from the Miami shootout, when the FBI got into the shootout with the felons in Miami,
right,
you couldn't see in the car. And even now, you know, in Florida, there's a state law against mirrored tint. Mirrored tint in Florida is illegal, and there's a lot of tint shops that still put it on there. And you can't see in the car day or night. And so you have to, obviously, it's extreme stress walking up. You don't know if someone's holding a gun or they're just holding their purse. You have no idea until they roll down the window and you know, kind of peek around the corner. And it may be, you know, someone's grandmother, someone's parents, or a bad guy. You just don't know.
And that brings me to something that always seems to come up, and I've wondered it myself sometimes. When I was growing up, it seems like there are always two officers in the car. Now, it's one to a car. Budget cuts, different techniques, communication. They've got that computer console in there. There's a lot in there. What's the advantage, disadvantage of the one versus two officer in a police car, police cruiser? I don't know what the current term is.
The advantage of one is that if you want to change the music station to something you like, you don't have to worry about someone else not liking your taste in music.
Well, that's practical.
But it adds more officer presence. You can get more officers on the street for the same price as you could with two. The disadvantage is officer safety comes at a sacrifice to that. And in law enforcement, we train plus one. So whatever happens, you have one more officer than the people or the persons you're in contact with. So if I stop a car and there's one person in the car, backup shows up just to make sure. So there's two officers, one person. And the public's perception of that can be, why is there so many officers or so many cops on the side of the road with this one car? Well, it's because there's probably, let's say, there's five people in the car. There's probably going to be six officers in some capacity, or hopefully, you know, three to four officers. So it looks aggressive, but it's a safety perspective for us to make sure that not only are we safe, but the public is safe as well. That way that if something does decide to go south, then there's enough officers there to handle it quickly so no one gets hurt.
Yeah, and that's how I've grown up. And as an adult been exposed to, that's how I've been grown to look at it, as more people, more officers, more cars. Especially with the lights on, even though it's a sunny day, but it makes quite an impression. And anyone who says that's not a bit of an overwhelming thing, even if you're, you know, the really bad guy, it seems like it is. And I'm told that if you got three or four cars even just sitting around, no one may be getting out, maybe they're just with the lights on, that really makes a presence. And one officer told me, and it gets the public out of the way. No one stops to look, especially if it's on a side street, and it oh my gosh, let's keep going, we don't want to go down there. It also clears rubberneckers out and hopefully moves people away who are not going to do anything other than get away. with that in mind, then, the next question would be, if you were to go a little further up the line, you find yourself in increasingly more dangerous situations during your career, not on the same day, but during your career. Are there stops along the way where you in your position or in the department say, hey, it's time for our every 2 year, tell us how you're doing, check up on not so much stress, but how you feeling? You still liking it? You still feel like it's what you want to do? Just to, because there's a lot of times that people will be very good at going along and doing things. I know what happens in every profession, medicine, sure, where people seemingly say, yeah, things are fine. And really, it's just become the doldrums, and that can be very stressful for someone. Not affecting job performance, but at the end of the day when you're home, it's really tough to keep your feet on the ground. You just don't feel like you're making a difference or contributing to your own life.
Unfortunately for us, no, there's not. We're not. We don't have a department psychologist, and I'm not familiar with any agency around me that actually does have a mental health checkup for any of the officers. It's once you take your normal psychological exam in the academy or post academy before you get hired, that's the last time that you'll be screened by a mental health care professional, unless something happens in your career or to you that you get referred to a mental health counselor or a mental health provider. One of the things that I've been trying to champion for several years now is to make it mandatory that we have a yearly checkup for mental health. We have a physical, we get our cholesterol checked, we get our right. heart checked, we take a stress test over 40, but there's nothing in place that I'm aware of in Florida, at least, that requires the officers to go sit down with someone who's been approved through the department, that has been obviously trained in law enforcement and in trauma, to sit down with the officer and go, have you been since last year? There's nothing in place here. And I'm hoping that one day we can get something like that spearheaded. If you normalize it, it reduces the stigma of participation. And there'll be things like, I got to go see the quack, I got to go see the head doctor, I got to go do this. But at the end, it allows them to not only get something out that they may not otherwise have gotten out, but a lot of times have it reflected back on them. And that may be the first time in their career or that year that they're hearing themselves say those words, and it may lead to some self-reflection, to let them do some self-assessment.
It's an increasingly violent world, fortunately, I think. And everybody has to look out. I mean, every time you turn around, there's another group or another person saying, this happened, that happened, watch your back. There's a lot. And are we becoming too hypervigilant? I say that not in a negative way, but almost in a... Are we making ourselves so vigilant that we're becoming, as a society, hyper-reactive when maybe we don't need to be?
We do have an odd cultural perspective of right and wrong. And here's a study I'll share with you. Recently in the UK, they did a PTSD study on their military veterans. And they found that their veterans exposed to the same trauma and or similar trauma that our veterans are exposed to in Iraq had a lower incidence of PTSD. And it's like a cultural phenomenon or what's expected of you going into it. They have a different perspective. For years, England and the IRA were at each other's throats, figuratively, and there's a lot of bombing. So they've been exposed to violence for decades, where we've been relatively peaceful in America. And the good thing about it is that we don't have any violence. The bad part is that we get kind of complacent, to where we are kind of left thinking, oh, you know, it's not going to happen to us. It happens elsewhere. So we kind of essentially we take our mental armor off and kind of say that happens elsewhere outside of our shores. It doesn't happen here. And then when it happens here, it shocks the collective consciousness of the community.
And And that brings us to sort of the biggest of the big pictures. Lots of stuff that officers are exposed to is pretty damn scary. I mean, it's nightmarish for a lot of times. So take a scenario, and you just spoke before about how you step up, just that mild intervention, but then there's the CISM. Talk a little bit about the CISM, when it would come into play, what it entails. And again, I think you hit on a very good point, bringing that in without making it a stigmatizing item.
For us at our department, we follow the International Critical Incident Stress Foundation's model for CISM. And essentially, there's a couple of facets of CISM. The first one is that if there was a major incident, I don't want to use 9/11 example, but something like a gross, a mass casualty incident, where the officers are going to be on station longer than a couple of hours and they're going to call in several squads to come in and help, we're going to activate our CISM team and just put them in the field with the officers, and it could be something as simple as handing out water. Here's a cold bottle of water for you. I know you've been on this traffic post for a couple of hours here. Those base human needs are intervened on first. That way that even then we know each other, so I can see, you know, if Jim or John or Jeff is having an issue, do they need to be relieved, go to the restroom, things like that. That's our first step for CISM. The second one is if there's an incident where CISM is activated, like post-incident, like the shooting I mentioned earlier, it's a mandatory attendance for everyone involved with the scene. Now, what I mean by that is, you're going to keep the fire guy separate from the police officers, and you're going to keep the dispatcher separate from the officers, and then even you're going to drill it down even further and say the officers on scene are going to have a separate debriefing than would say someone that come after the incident, or even the command staff. They're going to have their separate debriefings, and it may not reach the level of having the command staff debriefed, but during those times, for the CISM model we have, currently we partner through our employee assistance program. The team is, my CISM team is just recently formed, and we're going to start using our own preferred mental health provider for the officers. One of the things I found through this, you can't take someone who's not familiar with the way law enforcement works, nor can you bring someone who's not trained in trauma and have a successful CISM debriefing. So what we try to do is we try to partner with people that have an understanding of what law enforcement's about. The last gentleman that came over to help us out, his father and brother were in law enforcement. So he had an appreciation looking in at the cost of being a cop. And that immediately broke down the barriers from some of the officers, and they felt more compelled to share about an incident. I've been through several CISM debriefings, and the ones that went more successfully were the ones where someone knew something about law enforcement, and the ones that didn't go so well were the ones that someone, he may be a mental health counselor, she may be LMHC, which is licensed mental health counselor in Florida, they may have the best intentions in the world, but without them having some kind of bonding or some kind of credibility to us, it doesn't go very well.
How's the results with that? How are you gauging success of that, of the CISM intervention?
Certainly. The success rate varies, and it's all individualized to the officer. And what we do is when the debriefing is over, we give them all the information we can about signs and symptoms of acute stress, such as sleeplessness, restlessness, not maintaining your current hobbies or your routine. But we also provide them with referrals for follow-up services. So if they may not have wanted to share something in a CISM debriefing, then they can go meet one-on-one with a preferred mental health provider at any time. And it's essentially an open or blank check or an open door that at any time they can go speak to these providers. not only after the incident, but say a 6-month checkup. If they want to voluntarily go, or a year, they're more than welcome to stop by at any time to see that provider. And one of the things that we teach the supervisors is that if you see an increased pattern of behavior in the officer to where it's detrimental to their career, such as they're getting a lot of complaints for being rude, or they're getting a lot of use of force issues coming in, that we can stop right there and do an intervention and send the person for services.
Now, is that done as a group, one-on-one, or with a group? Is it a group of on-site, a group of direct involved people, direct? I mean, is it broken up into groups, or is each person individually separated out for CISM, or is it done as a group initially?
We use the group model, which is based off the Mitchell model. And here's an example. The shooting I mentioned earlier, there was approximately 7 officers involved. We bring those 7 in, and we have a debriefing for them. Then the dispatchers that were on duty, they'll have a separate debriefing. And the fire department showed up, they'll have a separate debriefing. So to focus on the officers, we brought those 7 officers in. They were in a group together, and the group, we use a circle of chairs, so there's nothing in between, no tables, no tissue, no footrests or anything. And this allows the mental health providers to see body language. And how the group process works is the mental health provider introduces himself, and we have the peer support team members there. And then we ask the people to introduce themselves. This way that the mental health provider had conceptualized what's going on. And we just asked, who are you and how are you involved? And if they don't want to share any other information after that, they don't have to. They can just sit in a room. Or if they want to be involved in the process, the group loosely runs through, I'm Officer Watson, I was the first officer through the door, or I was the first person to see this. And then the therapist will ask, you know, what was the best for you? What was the worst for you? And what did you realize that this situation was different from all the others? And what did you learn during this incident that you can use for you in the future in case this happens again? So we're teaching resiliency skills, even though we're doing a debriefing at the time.
We talked about this before, before we were on the show here tonight. And you've likely heard, and I have as well, significant criticisms of CISD, CISM, particularly the Mitchell model and some offshoots of that, as perhaps having neutral effect or perhaps an untoward effect, making things perhaps worse or not giving folks that have participated sort of time to get through it. What do you think about those? It's a bit of a hot button sometimes in this area.
It is. I've read several studies where they were found the CISD, which is the old version, to be ineffective or worse than without the intervention itself. And the research studies that I've read, they were applying either non-law enforcement trained people to a law enforcement debriefing, or they were trying to go to a mass casualty incident, say 9/11, and start CISM or CISD right away. And in law enforcement, it's a little bit different. There's a different resiliency factors. There's different personality factors involved. And by and large, law enforcement overall, the profession makes us very cynical, very jaded. So there's a different approach to a CISM debriefing for law enforcement than you would say to civilians for, say, New York City for 9/11, or the tsunamis in Japan, or the earthquakes. A little bit different application.
Yeah, I know the ICISF. That's the international. I think they're at icisf.org. Is it ICF? Yeah, ICISF, yes. Right?
Correct.
Yeah. I know a while back I was on their website. They've actually got a seems to be a fairly good review of the negative criticisms, the negative comments that are associated with it. And overall, there's been a number of folks who've addressed perhaps just single sessions, non-cohesive groups, that those models that it sounds like might be in a law enforcement circumstance not the same, that those are not CISM. Those are separate items. Is there any leaning towards discontinuing or limiting the participation to voluntary versus mandatory?
Not for my agency. For us, it's mandatory for all incidents that has been deemed CISM worthy, and we found it reduces the stigma of participation. The most opposed to CISM in my agency, or any agency for that matter, that comes up, those more opposed or more vocal, I should say, are generally the people that need to get help and the CISM is more beneficial for. And the reason I say that is I'm talking about society in general and the way that we view stuff. We were trained or taught from a very young age as men, don't cry, rub some dirt on it, walk a few laps, walk it off. And the older we get, the more that society sees that as being a strength, not a weakness. So we tend to bottle things up. And then in law enforcement, there's another level of suppression of your feelings. And if the thought is that if you cry as a police officer or you have any issues that you may not be tough enough to do it, when it really comes down to how we deal with stress. And having said that, the mandatory participation takes all those factors and just kind of squashes it.
What's been the feedback from participants?
For my agency and for the agencies that I've did some training with, such as the Orange County Sheriff's Office and the Orlando Police Department, it's been very positive. And it shows that there's someone there to care that cares, who helps the helpers, so to speak. And number two, I've never heard anyone so far, knock on wood, say anything bad about it other than the usual grumblings of, I don't see why I should have to go because I don't have a problem to begin with. Outside of that, all the feedback has been very positive. And in some instances, the officers involved confided in a group about something that had been giving them problems years ago that they're still struggling with, that this incident brought back those old feelings, brought back those old emotions, and now they have an intervention or a mental timeout, if you will, to be mindful of that and look at that and go, hey, wait a minute, I felt this way during this situation, now those same feelings are coming up. Hey, now I see there's people here that care about me and give me tips to help me move through this and get through it faster and help me in the future.
Overall, how much time does it take to be involved in that process? Is it hours, or is it the day, or is it more than that? How's the usual flow of time for that?
The usual flow.
From getting into it to where you say, we'll see you when you need to.
It usually takes 24 to 48 hours total from the time of incident to the time of the debriefing. And if you go past the 48-hour mark, it loses its effectiveness. You can't revisit this in a week or a month. You have to get on it relatively quickly. And it's been my experience that 24 hours has been key, and 48 is the longest you want the situation to go before it's addressed through CISM. And the group process itself, once they're in the group and talking, it can last anywhere from 1 to 3 hours. But generally speaking, it's about an hour and a half from start to finish, and that's when everyone comes out. And usually speaking, everyone's smiling. There's no one grumbling.
And overall, folks have Well, let me ask it a different way. Have you designed an objective measure of how that's done pre and post your initiation of this CISM into those circumstances where you feel it might be necessary? Are things generally better afterwards from past experience?
Yes, generally better. I'm keeping loose numbers. One of the things is it's after they're released back into the wild, so to speak, there's no tracking of the officer or the participants to see how they're doing other than peer support. There's no mandatory check-ins. It's all confidential and protected under HEPA. So even if I wanted to know those numbers, they would have to volunteer them for me. But overall, I can say that of the officers that I've spoken to and have been through CISM with and recommended for CISM, that after they received these intervention tools, they were, by large, much happier and much more productive and had a kind of a sense of normalcy faster than they would without it.
Does it seem to you that it's more effective in a more experienced middle or less experienced officer or member? Or is it more valuable / accepted? In the, how would you pan those groups out for acceptance and improvement, if you want to call it that, over career lifespan? Who gets the most bang for the buck, and who feels better about having done it?
I think it was it's really individualized to the person as far as that goes, and the older officers or more veteran officers who have not had to go through a debriefing before seem to be more resistant at first. And what I found is the younger officers, especially, let's say that the officers currently today in 2011 are in their mid to late 20s, they're more prone to talk about their issues and problems, whereas someone who's, say, 35 or older would not be. But once they get them in the room together, the younger officers can see, hey, veteran officer across from me is having the same problem with this incident that I am. So they can kind of normalize that and look at that and say, if he's feeling this way, then I'm justified in my feelings as well. So this process is going to help me essentially get rid of the feelings. I don't want to sound cynical about it, but it'll help them resolve those feelings faster.
How are you tied into that? Are you directly involved with conducting the sessions? Do you moderate? Do you gather, separate groups, etc.? You know, as you said, you kept the fire guys over there and law enforcement here and the ambulance guys in another part, so to speak. I'm over-exaggerating here. How do you fit into that, or are you the overarching sort of logistics director of this?
I'm the team's coordinator. One of the things that through my master's degree is I'm a member of the American Counseling Association, and their view is no previous relationships or prior relationships or dual relationships, as they refer to them, between the therapist and the member. Therefore, I remove myself from any of the therapeutic process. And my whole goal as I'm the team's coordinator is to A, train the team, but B, facilitate the services only as in coordinating time, place, and so on. I remove myself from any other part of the process to make sure that there's some neutrality in it, that I'm not trying to give to the officers and maybe kind of push them in a certain way.
How does that work for you? Seems like with your training, you'd want to jump in.
It does. A lot of times I'm just like, oh, if you could just, if so-and-so would just understand that this is going on or that's normal. It's sometimes frustrating because I can't relay some positive tips or coping skills or normalcy to the incident. So I just kind of sit on the sidelines and sit on my hands a lot.
Where's the cutoff? What's the level at which this might be applied? And here I make the distinction sort of between the big event, the trauma, the horrific aspect of things versus, you know, tempers flaring, fights, you know, the things that are sort of just what you see, part of the, I want to say routine, but part of the big picture for what you would see under normal, non-horrific, if there's a possibility of saying that. What makes that separation between, we had one of those today, from, wow, we never had one of those?
We could use that loosely. It's anything that the command staff has deemed unusual, and that is very subjective, and we could apply that to anything. And what's normal in law enforcement obviously isn't normal outside the
right.
Law enforcement.
That's why I was asking it like that.
I don't want to, again, this is sounds cynical and jaded, but shootings, stabbings, homicide scenes, those things do not require a CISM call out. When it would require a CISM call out is usually the death of a child, like at a homicide of a child, or something that exceeds the normal scope of things, like an officer's hurt, an officer's killed, an officer involved shooting, and those type of things that require a little bit more time for people to go, that didn't seem right. That's when CISM is brought in.
Okay. So it's really a inter-department, not compared with other departments. It's your department says, this is outside of our, and I'm using the word because it's an easier way to put it, usual scope of experience, and we think this is something different or above or worse or more than, quote, usual, like you were describing. So it's not an everyday thing. You don't go to a domestic dispute and find yourself in front of someone sitting there going, how'd you feel about that?
Correct.
Okay. Well, because I think sometimes a lot of folks think, oh, my gosh, you know, every time I, answer the radio, maybe my, at the other end of the shift, there's going to be somebody, oh, my gosh, do I want to join the force if I'm going to be sitting down in front of somebody at the end of the day saying, you know, how do you feel about that? That might be tough. I don't think anyone would do that in any walk of life. It'd be tough.
No, it would definitely add to the stress.
And we're getting a little close on time here. I don't want to take much up. A couple quick questions at the end. Overall, how's the basic interest in joining law enforcement? Seems like it's on the rise.
It is. I'm getting several calls a day and emails. It seems that there's an increased interest in law enforcement. Not quite sure what that stems from yet. Some people attribute it to a downturn in the economy. Being in law enforcement's a guaranteed paycheck, so to speak. But other people see it as a positive, and it's maybe people who hadn't thought about law enforcement before are giving us a second look based on various socioeconomic reasons, or that maybe they're it's a stage in their life ready to make a change.
I've had a couple of people mention that applications are up, quality applications, not just folks, you know, running in going, well, I guess I'll try this. True applications, people who say, well, I've done some work and some research and they want to get in. And probably not the last question, but what's the state of law enforcement in terms of its presence in the community, presence in the society, with acceptance? We kind of brushed on this before. You feel like people appreciate that someone's driving around at night saying, don't worry, I got you, go back to sleep?
I do. There's a lot of times, and you mentioned earlier, that it feels like a thankless job where you go unnoticed And for the everything we see on YouTube, for example, there's millions of examples of officers doing the right thing. And I think that by and large, as the presence of law enforcement's around, that generally speaking, the public appreciates what we do, even if they may not agree with interdepartment politics or the police department views of where they live. But generally speaking, for the individual officer, I believe that there's a definite appreciation for them.
Anything you want to put out there, Jeff, that's something you feel is something you want to give information on, or a website, or something that people can check and look into it more?
Certainly. For those living in Florida, the first thing I would recommend was to check out NAMI, which is the National Alliance on Mental Illness. NAMI is started off as a grassroots organization, and they've expanded into the realm of providing family-to-family and peer-to-peer classes, meaning that for families who may have a family member suffering from mental illness, they can go to NAMI, which is NAMI.org, and they can look at when classes are coming up, and to let them know that there's organizations out there championing the cause of mental illness and mental health in general. There's also ICISF.org, which is the International Critical Incident Stress Foundation. We touched on that earlier, but they have a wealth of information to include military veterans and the officer who may be a reservist or National Guardsman who may be deployed. They have definite resources for them. And for those in Orlando, there's NAMIGO.org, which is NAMI Greater Orlando. And for those of us in Brevard County, there's SpaceCoastNAMI.org. And we have meetings the first Tuesday of each month at the public library in Titusville. And I can't tell you how passionate I am about mental health and mental illness and where NAMI fits into the picture. I've been a member of NAMI for several years, and think that it would allow everyone to see not only is it what's normal in society, use that word loosely, but also provide them with services that they may feel would best serve them.
And I'm going to add one thing here. We talked about this before, and I've seen a lot of veterans, and I think that you and I spoke about this, but there is a guidebook out there put out by the Department of Justice. I think it's the Bureau of Justice Assistance, but the title of it is Double Duty, A Guidebook for Families of Deployed Law Enforcement Officers. I think we spoke about that. I've read through that, and other people have, and it's excellent. Excellent, and I think you may have mentioned it, and I just didn't run it through as I was listening. It's great publication, and I think it's very valuable, especially for families who are thinking, well, what's going to happen, and for law enforcement who are deployed and then come back. You may have seen it. When I mentioned it, you said, "Oh yeah, I've seen that." So that's also put out by.
Yes, it's a must read for any law enforcement who's a National Guard or reservist, or in general anyone that's been deployed in the military. It's a must read.
Yeah, I think that's I think it's the International Association of Chiefs of Police that's behind that as well. So, Officer Jeff Watson, thank you so much for being on the show. It was a pleasure. It's enlightening. It's great to hear a perspective of someone on so many fronts who's out there while I'm sitting in here quietly and comfortably. And when the siren goes off, I don't have to think, oh, my gosh, I know somebody's, as I too often say sometimes, got my back. Thanks for being on the show. Anytime you want to come back, something comes up, feel free. We'll be glad to have you on again. And on behalf of the listeners and anyone else who may hear this later as a tape, thanks so much. And again, this is Men Matter. Our guest tonight was Officer Jeff Watson of the Titusville Police Department with topics on mental health and stress as it applies to law enforcement. And from those of us who appreciate everything you do, thank you.
Thank you for having me. It's been a great pleasure.
Jeff, be well, and we'll talk again perhaps in the future very soon.
Yep.
Good night to all. Bye for now.